Want more information about This Week with Ann Carrick and Vincent Caprio? Visit AnnCarrick.com for details.
Welcome back to the show. And in the studio with us now is Edna Novak, who is the executive director for of Teach for America in Connecticut. So, Edna, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you here because our topic tonight is education in the United States. So Teach for America is sort of an interesting program. I mean, I guess I could summarize that you try to attract some of the best teachers and they commit to 2 years in a underprivileged area to try to help bring up the quality of education in areas where it's sort of lacking. Is that...
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. We just believe that our nation is facing a huge crisis in education today. When we look at the U.S. today compared to even 10 years ago, in 95, a little over 10 years ago, we were tied for first for college graduation rates internationally, and today we're 14th. Today we are 21st in science, 25th in math across OECD industrialized nations. And when we step back and think about what it's going to take to solve this problem, we believe that it's going to take tremendous leadership in our schools, certainly teachers and school leaders, but also leaders in policy and business and law and medicine. So we look for young leaders who are in all those fields, who are interested in pursuing careers in lots of different directions. We recruit our nation's top leaders to teach for at least 2 years, as you said, in low-income schools. In Connecticut, we have 150 teachers in New Haven, Bridgeport, Hartford, and a few in Stanford as well. And after those 2 years, we find that the majority actually commit to continuing in education. Two-thirds of our alumni, of 20,000 alumni 20 years later, are still working in education.
Wow. So when you recruit them, they're not necessarily in education to begin with. They're just people who have those skills and that knowledge and the interest to
right.
make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I was someone who came in thinking I would teach for 2 years and go to law school, and I taught for 2 years in outside of New Orleans, Louisiana, back in 2002, and my kids just completely changed the direction of my life, just to see how capable all students are when given the opportunity,
right.
and
right.
we set those expectations.
Right. I had heard about it. I'm over 50, and I went on the website, and I said, let me take a look at this, because I know of somebody else that is over 50 that quote-unquote retired from Wall Street. And I looked at it and I thought the application process that they have is so comprehensive. I mean it's not as if you just
you don't just raise your hand and say, oh, I'll do it.
Like, hey, I've done well in life and let me just email in.
It's very rigorous.
And you have to have it in by a certain day and it's
like a college application.
It is
much
very
more
rigorous
than that, even. Yeah, they really screen people pretty really rigorously.
Yeah, about 1 in 10 people who apply to Teach for America meet our criteria, and we've developed our criteria over 20 years by actually looking at results in the classroom. It might seem like a very obvious idea to anybody out there working in other industries to think about what's the outcome.
Gee,
that we
let's
want.
See what worked and replicate it, right?
And do you have people that used to work in, say, the pharmaceutical industry for, say, 25 years that are 52 years old that apply for something like
we
that?
We do. We get a mix of we recruit aggressively amongst recent college graduates and young professionals because we want people to join us early on in their career, mm-hmm. and we want this to be what determines the rest of their life.
Right.
However, we find an increasing number of mid-career professionals joining us. Even here in Connecticut, we have several core members right now who someone who used to run his own business. We have several former lawyers, people who are changing careers and looking to make an impact this way.
But I guess if you recruit with people who are right out of school, somebody like yourself, where all of a sudden then it changes your direction, now you've got somebody who's committed to the effort for a long period of time, as opposed to somebody who, I mean, let's face it, if it's their second career, they retired and they're doing this,
right.
How long are they going to continue? And they might love it, but
Right. We find most of the people joining us mid-career are probably going to continue to teach, whereas we look at the alumni who joined us in 1990 when we first got started. And in the early 90s, 20 years ago, in the entire first decade, we brought in fewer people than we brought in last year alone. And the people who hail from that era, we find a third of our overall 20,000 alumni at this point are still teaching, but the other third are principals, they're superintendents. We even have a superintendent in Connecticut, in Torrington, who's a Teach for America alum who started.
So they're still in education. They're just not standing in a classroom maybe, but they're still working on the whole process.
Two-thirds are, and the other third are critical. We actually want to see many more of our alumni continuing in other fields like policy and business. We want to see school board members, city council members, state legislators. We want to see mayors and people in business and law and medicine who have taught successfully, seen that kids can learn, also seen the tremendous barriers, and whether it's nutritional deficiencies or changes in law and policy that need to happen, we find that our alumni who have taught are much more motivated due to the experiences they had with their kids to make that kind of an impact.
Sure. You know, you said something earlier when you started that, you know, how we're 14th and or in all these different things are, you know, and math and science. And do you have the statistics that show, is that people have chosen a different path? I mean, it's not like we don't know how to do math and science. It's just that the individuals have chosen to go into something else. I mean, that's kind of the feeling I got. If you look at, like Vincent said, the people who are, you know, early 50s, you know, when they were going through school, for example, being an engineer was... like, that was, like, the best thing you could do. If you were an engineer, everybody thought, oh, you know, like, I'm not worthy, you're too good for me.
Yeah.
Whereas that shifted to all of a sudden, everybody went into finance. They all wanted to be on Wall Street and make tons of money because, you know, while being an engineer was good, the money was on Wall Street. So they kind of shifted. So those same people who were maybe, you know, mathematically inclined shifted in another direction. I mean, is that part of it also?
I think that's part of it. I think more than that, though, there is a growing... gap. We talk about the achievement gap, both in this country, but also a huge growing gap between the performance of kids growing up in the United States relative to other countries in the world. And I think that's in part because other countries are starting to outpace us and focus on different things.
But in my research, isn't that gap between the suburban and exurbious schools versus the urban schools? Because if you grow up in the suburbs of New York, or Illinois, like Lake Bluff, Lake Forest, Highland Park, East Coast, West Coast, prominent suburbs, these children are doing very well. They're going to college. They're graduating from college. But urban, 50% of the children don't graduate from high school. So if we could get the high school graduation rates to 80% in urban areas, all those numbers would go up.
It's definitely a huge part of the problem, in part because we see so much poverty in
right.
urban schools. However, we do see troubling statistics in many communities, whether rural and suburban communities in Connecticut and across the United States that suggest that our performance as a nation needs to improve, both in absolute terms and also in terms of what we're providing to kids at many different ends of the spectrum. And so when we look at the statistics I referenced earlier actually apply to students taking exams in their K-12 education in math and science that compare us. They're called, you know, PISA tests, this program
right.
for
right.
national.
So it's really how much they've learned so far, not what direction they choose
right.
to go in with their career.
And then even more troubling is that as a nation today, I mean, our high school graduation rate a generation ago was first in the world, and today we're also 14th or 15th alongside our college graduation rate, which is something that we need to change. And when we think about all the things that contribute to this and look at other countries in the world that have higher performing school systems today, their structures are incredibly different. The world's top three school systems today are Finland, South Korea, and Singapore. And Finland is 100% unionized. Their kids don't start going to school until they're 7 years old. They only attend school for 4 to 5 hours a day. Singapore and South Korea, polar opposite.
Right.
Yeah,
which is interesting, though, that it's not necessarily that they need to be in the classroom for more hours. It's just that we need to be better while they're there at what we're giving them.
And that's what's so striking about these three countries are three countries in the world that recruit their teachers for lots of different structural reasons. Their teachers are hailing from the top third, 100% of their teachers are hailing from the top third of their college graduating classes, whereas in the U.S., the reverse is true. And that's grown over time for a lot of different reasons.
Has that improved any? Because I graduated from college in 1979, and when I graduated, they didn't have teaching wage minimums. I know this seems hard to believe, but a teacher was making $7,500 when I graduated, and an engineer was making $17,000, and an accountant, which I was making $15,000. So at the time when I graduated in the 70s, people that were studying teaching were in the bottom 10th, the lowest 10th percentile of college graduates. Now, that...
this is where that horrible expression that, you know, that, you know, those who can't do teach or something.
But it came out of the 70s.
Well, right, but that's what I'm saying. But that's where that came from,
right.
because I think people use it as a default, like, well, they don't know what they want to do, and they haven't, you know, they didn't do that well in school, so they'll just teach. Well, you know, which is not what you want in the classroom.
And then what happened, exactly. In about 1980 or 81, many of the states started passing minimums. New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and the minimum, they brought it up to 14,000, then it scaled up to about 20, and now it's, I think, about 40 to 45. And it's interesting because states like Florida don't have those minimums.
Right, and I do think pay is a huge part of it. It says something that as a nation, I mean, as a college graduate choosing to teach, I was choosing to make a salary at the time of less than $30,000 a year in Louisiana, and I could have gone to McKinsey and be making over $100,000 graduating immediately out of college or gone into law or medicine. I think it says a lot about our priorities. However, I think it's mistaken to believe that it's just about funding. I think that funding is a symptom of a much broader set of factors that that lead our young people, our students graduating from high school and graduating from college, to, as you said, believe that teaching is not where I'm going to go if I want to be seen as someone who's successful and who's doing the most that I can with my life.
But in Singapore, it is.
But in Singapore, it is. In Finland, it is. And Finland's an example of a country
where... When you said they recruit people, in other words, they don't just let you sign up to teach. They actually go out and look for the people they want.
Right, which is what we do in any industry where we're looking to make incredibly ambitious results in a challenging environment. We know that people are everything. And we say, what's the result we want? Who are we? What can we learn from the teachers who we have today, from our most outstanding teachers, and who we're looking for in the first place? And let's go out and recruit, select, train, and support teachers and pay them what they deserve so that we're retaining our most capable talent.
It just seems to me over the last 20 years, the suburban and exurban school systems have gotten stronger and the urban school systems have gotten weaker. And when people in the suburbs start talking about the problem of education, there's really not a big problem of education in the suburbs. The problem's in the urban areas.
Definitely.
That's why I try to explain to people, it's two different conversations.
I definitely agree that there's a growing achievement gap between kids growing up in poverty and not in Connecticut and across this country. But I also believe that we haven't raised our standards in education in our nation as a whole to the degree that we need to compete globally, and that is a problem affecting students growing up in suburban communities as much as it is students growing up in urban areas.
And Wayne, we've had you on the phone, but I know we haven't really given you a chance to say anything. You spend a lot of time speaking to students at different schools, and they're all public schools, correct?
Yes. Well, actually, the majority are public schools, but I actually do speak at some private and parochial schools as well. And one of the things I want to tell you is if we're talking about the achievement gap, if you have a rope that's broken and you're trying to sew it together, you pull it from both ends to put it together. Well, we have to pull the gap from both ends. I've sat in at Board of Education meetings right in Bridgeport. Mm-hmm. I've sat in Board of Education meetings in Fairfield, and the atmosphere is 180 degrees different.
Yes.
So from the parents that show up and demand the accountability from their school board and from their leaders in Fairfield, where there is almost none. In Bridgeport, the meetings that I covered for WICC, there was about the same 10 to 12 parents that would show up that were your regulars, but there was a total different set of accountability. Also, when you travel to different school systems and you look at the resources that they have, you can see that in the suburban schools, by and large, you get a different education than you do in the urban schools, and that is because of resources. There's no money. You can look right in Bridgeport, Waterbury, Hartford. There's no money.
And while money doesn't solve
reasons for that, but
yeah,
the problem is actually from both ends. From the top down, yes, it's resources and the priority that is put on education or the lack thereof. And from the bottom up, unfortunately, many of our parents and by default the students don't put the same importance or impetus on education. So you have to pull it from both ends.
So that, and you're a pretty straight shooter, and a lot of people don't like to talk about this. So my daughter's in seventh grade, and I live in Easton, okay? So, and I'm with the Easton Learning Foundation, a nonprofit which interfaces with the Board of Education, and we look at the curriculum, and we raise money. And so, and I have a friend at work who lives in Bridgeport, and she has a daughter in seventh grade. So what actually is the difference? Does my daughter have a different curriculum because my daughter's in pre-algebra and the girl in Bridgeport that's in seventh grade is not in pre-algebra and she's being taught at a fifth grade level where my daughter...
There are different curriculums because I did junior achievement and I... When I lived in Miami, I did it in the Miami public school system. And then I moved up here and offered to do it again. They sent me to Wilton. As you might guess, Miami schools and Wilton are not the same.
Right.
And for people who don't remember, junior achievement is usually where the class runs a business of some sort. And in Miami, they had the students themselves had, for the most part, no idea of anything about running a business. And when we would go to organize things, they didn't know... And anything about, like, who to go to ask questions, you know, or ask for resources, like local businesses that wanted to participate, nothing. In addition, obviously, there was a language element there where I had a lot of students for whom English was a second language, and so they struggled a little bit depending on what we were talking about. And then I went to Wilton, you know, and between classes, I would come back the next time to talk about what the next topic was, and they had all... met together at some coffee shop and gone over everything and tapped into three or four parents who were had their own businesses. They were done. They were way ahead of whatever our next step was. And part of that was because of their living situation. In other words, their role models. They had people who owned businesses.
Can you talk to these differences?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, because I don't understand.
But it is different. So I mean,
I went to public schools and I grew up, you know, lower middle class. And, you know, why can I name every president? I don't...
Yeah.
I mean, in the 60s, if somebody lived in a wealthy community, they didn't get a better education than the kid that lived in a poor community when I was growing up.
That's the case now.
Why is that?
If you go to inner city schools and you go to other wealthier schools, they don't have the same stuff. They just don't. I'm basically, my territory where I speak from is from upper Massachusetts above Boston all the way down to the coal mining area down in Pennsylvania. And I speak it.
Now, you put kids, you put, I want to hear from you,
Edna's dying to say something. Go ahead.
Because you put teachers
in
urban schools.
On the one hand, of course resources are important, and I think that knowing that kids growing up in poverty face huge challenges. Kids and families living in poverty face huge challenges that kids growing up in...
On top of whatever they're trying to do at school, every day.
But even talking about middle-class people.
And so for me, I grew up in Ithaca, New York, a system where there's one high school, everybody goes to the same...
They closed the McDonald's there, so that's no...
So in Ithaca, New York, a kid growing up in Ithaca, whether you're the son of a child of a professor, or you're living downtown in... a more impoverished area, you're going into an environment where 80 to 90% of kids in the system are expected to go to college, and that's the expectation.
Right.
And so for a child growing up in that system, what we need to do is really different than a child growing up in Bridgeport or in Hartford, where the challenges are just tremendous and where at the system level we need to be doing things differently. What I would say, so I believe resources are critical. That said, I think since 1980, education spending in the United States has increased almost twofold. It's increased about 75%, and we have not seen any difference in student outcomes.
So are we spending in the wrong place?
I've gone into classrooms in this state where, due to various grants, I've been in a classroom recently where the school was able to get purchase a computer for every child in the school, and I go into a classroom. Fortunately, this is not a Teach for America Corps member, and every child is behind the computer, and the teacher is teaching, and as I look around the room, not a single student is focusing on the classroom, the subject at hand. Everybody is on Facebook or Gmail or you name it.
During class.
Of course, because you can have all the resources and technology you want, but it's about the leadership of whose hands it's in. And when we have effective leaders in front of the classroom, in front of the school, in front of the district level, they're able to, who are able to maximize their resources, we see results.
But sounds like they need the D word. They used to call that discipline back in my day.
A lot of resources behind a problem and not see results if you don't have the right people, which is why I believe just talent leadership is so important. And when we see schools, school systems, and countries working on that factor on talent and leadership, we do see results. And I have to make a comment about parents and families because, goodness, I feel like I think here in Connecticut, where we have about 120,000 kids in poverty in our school system, give or take, depending on how you measure it, we're talking about, I'll speak from my own experience outside of New Orleans, Louisiana, where I taught in an 100% African-American, 100% below the poverty line environment, and where the failure rate in our school was what's out of control. But where I started off the year, of course, idealistic, coming in without any sense of the challenge before me, and wanting to get to know my parents, my students' parents, and my students immediately, calling them all up on, you know, before the first day of school, introducing myself to them at their homes week by week, calling every five parents a night for the first few weeks of school until I got to know everybody and I was able to just communicate what my vision was for their students and start to really invest my students' families in what they could accomplish. It was amazing to see how many families and parents came out of the woodwork to do what they could to support our work. Ultimately, that year, we had parents who together came to fundraise so that their students could go on a field trip, you know, long distance field trip to Ithaca, New York to meet their pen pals in the following spring. We saw parents coming in to volunteer in the classroom, et cetera. And I guess my point with this story is that when we have a vision for our community, when we have classroom leaders, teachers and principals and school leaders at the system level who have a clear vision that they want to invest our parents and students in, then parents and students will get involved. And I see that happening in classrooms of teachers here in Connecticut. I see it happening in the entire school level and in some schools in Connecticut as well. And I just believe that it's possible for us to see that in Bridgeport as a whole and Connecticut as a whole when we have visionary leaders.
Okay. And before we go on to something else, we do have a phone call from Mike, who's in Monroe, and we may have addressed this, but Mike, I guess, has a question about teachers' salaries now versus the past. So, Mike, hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you very much.
Good. What was your question?
Well, two issues. One is, I heard someone say earlier that the graduation rate, or our stature as the United States with regards to graduation rates, were much higher when the salaries were much lower.
Oh yeah, the grad.
Oh yes,
yeah.
Yes,
correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. And I think you've said it, but it's not necessarily a money issue.
Yes, she did.
It's not money alone,
right?
For sure.
Right.
Not money.
No, it's not money. But it shouldn't be money at all.
But money does help.
That,
right? I don't want to say resources don't matter. In fact, there's some studies out recently that show that teacher salaries actually could be a huge factor in attracting higher achieving college graduates into the profession. So it's certainly a factor.
Correct. But my point is there are other resources, and I think one of the gentlemen, I think it was Wayne, whoever's on the phone,
Wayne, right,
has you know talked. He says he's talked to parochial schools. Now I've sent my kids to parochial school. For a bunch of reasons, faith being one of them, but the quality of education being one of them. And when we talk about gaps in education, for less resources, there is a much better, and I'm not saying it's apples to apples, there's a much better educational system in terms of graduation rates, in terms of kids going on to college, in those systems. And when that model has been replicated, whether it be magnet schools and things like that, they've been pretty much wildly successful. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, 70, what I think we said, you know, 75% increase in spending or whatever it was, it's twofold in the last
trillions of dollars.
Year.
Don't get me going.
Doesn't this tell you that the system we have today is broken?
Yes.
Well, that's the whole point of our show today. So, and Mike, so I'm gonna have you back on hold unless you had something else you wanted to add, because we're gonna have to take a break soon anyway.
No, that's it. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Mike. We appreciate the call. You know, and do you want to respond to that? And then
sure.
We'll take a quick break.
You know,
they have standards and they stick to them.
Well, yes, that's true. Standards, and they stick to them. You're right, Wayne.
I wouldn't. Correlation is not causation. I would not say we should return to the days of $7,500 teacher salaries. Every teacher I know in Connecticut would hang me tonight if they found out that I made that statement. I think
his only point was that you can't just keep throwing money at it. You really need to change the process.
I completely agree with that. I do think we have a system-wide crisis for which talent and leadership is key. And I think when we can see in any industry, any sector you look at, that when we are obsessive about who we hire, when we're obsessive about who we're retaining and how we're developing in them and the support that we're providing, in terms of results, when we're talking about classrooms, we're talking about student learning. So when we let student learning be the center of what determines who we hire, how much we pay them, who we're retaining, how we're supporting them, and all the other resources we provide, I think we'll end up with a much more efficient educational system overall, where we don't see the exorbitant increases in spending that have happened over the last generation.
Right. All right, we are going to take a quick break here on This Week. We'll come back. We'll talk more about education, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the issues that are going on locally in Connecticut and also here in Bridgeport. Don't go away.